I am delighted to introduce our guest this evening, Michelle Garcia Winner, who we are very honored is presenting for us tonight. Michelle is the founder of Social Thinking, which specializes in developing treatment models and specific strategies for helping persons with social cognitive learning challenges. She runs a small clinic, has authored numerous books, and speaks internationally. Ms. Winner's goal is to help educators, psychologists, psychiatrists, mental health counselors, and parents appreciate how social thinking and social skills are integral parts of students' academic, vocational, and community success. She was honored with a Congressional Special Recognition Award in 2008. I'm also going to introduce our technical facilitator, Eitan, who will be working with us and can be reached through the chat box if you have any technical difficulties. Welcome to everyone, and Michelle, the floor is yours.
Thank you. Nice to be able to speak to you guys tonight. I am on the very warm West Coast. I keep hearing about the East Coast, so I won't brag. But social thinking is, the talk I'm going to give tonight is one part of what social thinking is about and not all of what social thinking is about, as it's hard to get through all of it within an hour. But I really want to get you guys some practical ideas related to this. Social thinking is designed specifically for use with students as well as adults, students as young as 4 years old, as you work with them. I still work in my clinic, and our oldest client's in his 70s. He's retired, and his family wanted him to keep working on social skills, even in his retirement, to make life a little easier on them. And it's been very successful. So our youngest client, as I mentioned, is about 4. What they have in common is that they have solid to very high-level language and academic learning skills. I started in the field of autism in the late 1970s working with intellectually challenged nonverbal, minimally verbal kids. And when I started working in a high school district in the mid-90s, I realized with our highly verbal folks, many getting diagnosed with Asperger's or ADHD or different labels, that we needed a wholly different type of treatment than just teaching them social skills and reinforcing approximation and having them memorize skills. So it is really important that this work is a differentiated instruction for those with solid to very high learning abilities, including gifted and talented. Our goals today are going to define how the process of social thinking is required for the production of more sophisticated skills. And what I mean by sophisticated social skills is I think we all know the clients who really aren't able to produce sophisticated skills. They have very poor self-awareness, and they make a, you know, kind of, they memorize what they're supposed to do, and they say hi the same way to everyone no matter what the situation. And we work with those clients, too, but we also work up to the most nuanced, challenged, really teaching the subtleties of problem solving, what your social behavior should be in different situations. I'm going to be explaining a little bit about how the mind assists in reading comprehension, written expression, narrative language. We're going to look at least 3 social thinking vocabulary concepts. And I started publishing work after my audiences, some of the first I spoke to years ago, immediately requested that I develop books for them to be able to learn more about what I was speaking about. And over the years, they requested that we develop materials to put into the hands of kids that they could use while they are teaching or parenting to directly teach some of our concepts. So I'm going to wrap up the talk with going over some of those. There is not one diagnosis that we're talking about here today. We're talking about all different types of diagnosis. People who have social learning challenges may have many different labels associated with them. The more typical your presentation, the more normal you look, the more likely it's going to be that you have a mental health diagnosis rather than an autism spectrum diagnosis. But when we peel it all back, we can see that there's still some really compelling social learning challenges for folks of all different type of diagnosis. I've done grand rounds for psychiatrists and over the years worked with a lot of mental health teams, and I've learned that we actually have more diagnostic labels than the brain has problems for. So this is not a talk about autism spectrum disorders. It is a talk about social learning. So make sure this is a big paradigm shift that we don't get stuck that tonight's talk is only for people who have Asperger's or autism. It actually applies quite broadly, and as I'll mention, the materials can also be used in the mainstream as they're finding this is helpful information for all kids to be exposed to as part of social emotional learning. So what is social thinking? If you consider your own thinking, it's the ability to consider your own and others' thoughts, emotions, beliefs, intentions, knowledge, to help interpret and respond to the information in your mind and possibly through your social behavioral interactions. So what that all means is you and I don't just walk up to people, memorize social skills, and start applying those while we're talking to them. We actually have goals. This relates to executive functioning. We have social goals, whether we want to be seen as polite, friendly, whether we want someone to ignore us, whether we want someone to know that we're annoyed. And so we understand our intentions, but we also understand how people are going to be reading us. And we're understanding that what we do is going to be interpreted and responded to, and we have to figure out kind of our social action plan in our mind. And our social action plan helps us to figure out the next part, which is the but now also consider that if you're at home watching watching the news, you have to figure out I got a screen pop up from WebMX. That as you're watching a TV show, if you're watching a news broadcast, you have to realize what channel you're on to realize how they're biasing the news. So all of this is how are you interpreting information? How are you responding to it? If you're watching a sports game, you realize that people are trying to fake each other out on the court. So our mind is constantly trying to consider what we're observing, whether it's in media, whether you're reading a novel at home like I do every night before I go to bed, I'm jumping into the minds of characters. So social thinking is kind of our meaning maker that helps us be able to interpret information, get into reasoning and critical thinking as we get older, and this is all going to be tied later into the Common Core Standards as we'll talk about. So that's the thinking part, and if you realize that we're constantly thinking about those who are around us, even if we're not talking to them, when we're maybe just observing something and not interacting, but we're still engaged in the thinking process, and that's a big part of what we're teaching. The next aspect then, if we're engaged in social thinking, that drives us towards our social behavioral response. So what we do, what we call social skills, are really social behavioral adaptations. We adapt our behavior effectively based not only on the people, but what is the situation. So if it's you're coming into a classroom, you're expected to behave differently than if you're sitting in the class and participating in the classroom. If you're getting ready for recess, that's a different set of behaviors. And so in a nutshell, good social skills are a result of social problem solving. And they're all about you achieving that people understand you in the manner you had hoped. So if you want to be friendly, people see you as friendly. If you want to show people you're annoyed, people see you as annoyed. If you want to avoid someone and they read you that you want to avoid them, you can argue that you had good social skills because that was your goal and you adapted your behavior to meet that goal. So as in these opening remarks, as I started to develop social thinking, I really started thinking about what are social skills and why do we use them? Because these kids I was working with at the high school level were arguing about they didn't want to use social skills, they didn't care, it didn't matter what people thought. So I started trying to figure out what are social skills, how do we learn them? We certainly don't memorize them. I went into the field of anthropology, cultural linguistics, outside of education, speech pathology, which I'm a speech pathologist. That's where we study how man lives in society. And I found that in public health, in schools, we teach social skills without having really studied what social skills are. And that's what social thinking comes in with. All right, we got these kids with solid to high IQ. Let's teach them really a little bit more about this complexity and understand the thinking mechanisms that are driving the behavior change. This is also aligned with cognitive behavioral therapy for those of you who are counselors or therapists in the audience. So then one of my students in high school kind of challenged me, and he said, well, I'm not going to bother. It's too much thinking about what you're thinking about what I'm thinking about how you're reading my behavior, how I'm supposed to read your behavior. I'm out. I'm not dealing with it. So we started just trying to figure out why bother? Like, why do we do all this stuff? And that led us to realize, you know, the reason we use social skills is because we impact how it makes people feel, which impacts how people feel about us. It impacts how we feel about ourselves. So if you really, you know, scroll down on this, you'll see that when you're drilling into it, that our social skills are all about emotions, that we impact feeling states. Man, woman, boy, girl, this is not gender specific. Everybody has emotional reactions. Think in your own minds and your experiences that you will remember how someone made you feel. You may not remember, likely don't remember what they said to you. But we are emotional creatures who our relationships are really about how we connected or did not connect emotionally. And so it's important the three parts of this, that we engage in a social thinking, perspective-taking process that also looks at context. We understand how we adapt our behaviors towards the purpose of affecting how other people feel. So based on that, I've come up with a lot of different treatment ideas. And I'm going to throw in here that some of the work I'm not talking about tonight is from the time I started working with the more verbal group, who have solid to high intelligence, not everybody was at the same level in the social kind of playing field, that there were some who are obviously less able to engage in social self-awareness and were more literal. I had other students who looked more typical but were really kind of outcast in a very subtle way and perhaps more bullied than other kids. So we've created a scale of different levels of the social mind. We have a lot of free materials on our website. This is only one of many different ideas that we've been creating out there. So as we go into this talk, I don't want you to think that we do the exact same lesson for every person. We group kids based on their different social learning abilities. But as we group them, we understand, we've got to figure out how well does this person understand the social thinking mechanism, what's going on with their social behavioral responses, and how are they interpreting others, and do they know that they're being interpreted, and do they understand their own and others' emotions and how their behaviors affect how other people feel and react to them. So the social academic connection, if we come back to the social thinking part of this, we'll see that most schools, in fact, most educators and, in fact, administrators are not really trained in the power of our social cognition. We think that teachers teach everything in school, academics. But in the social world, we find that the social mind leads us to interpretation. So it makes sense that the social mind leads us to academic interpretation, such as being able to comprehend literature, being able to write a paragraph where you can explain yourself to an audience in a manner that makes sense to the reader, being able to self-regulate in the classroom or working as part of a group, and your narrative language. How do you explain yourself when you're speaking in class? How do you know how long your answer should be when you raise your hand? How do you understand that you need to stay on point and not go off into a tangent? How do you even know what a tangent is? It has to do with your social mind's ability to focus on ideas, perspective taking, central coherence in the research, executive functioning are all what are coming together here. And so that's another area I'm going to touch on here, but we've written more about in other books. I have a book out called Why Teach Social Thinking, where I get a lot into the social academic connection and how this relates to the Common Core or state standards. So to make more sense of this, consider the following story. So there's a man who's out in a park, and this is a YouTube clip, actually. There's you can look at it from AmeriQuest. It's a man who's out walking in a park with his dog, and he's unwrapping a brownie. And as he goes to unwrap the brownie, he drops it at the backside of the dog by the tail. So he reaches down, picks up the brownie, and he's picking it up right where the back of the dog is standing. And he brushes it off, and right then these onlookers are walking by, a grandmother and a granddaughter, and they look and see the man, and they look happy until they see him picking up this brown lump that's at the backside of a dog. They see him brush it off and eat it. And now the onlookers look at him with a horrified look. And the man looks back at them and smiles until he kind of understands their face and realizes that they probably think he's eating dog feces. And then he looks horrified too. So it's a pretty funny clip. It's, you know, less than a minute long. And if you're watching it on YouTube, in the form of a video clip. We just call it leisure viewing. But if that same video was written into a short story, then we call it reading comprehension. But if you watch the video and we asked you to write it out in a narrative paragraph, now we call it written expression. But the full understanding of the inference, the understanding the world, how the world works, considering the situation, the man picking this up from the back of a dog, we look at all the powerful interpretations we're doing in the social mind to take perspective of the man has to take perspective of the onlooker, and that's all about what we do in classrooms when we have to read history and understand inferences about man and society. We have to do that, obviously, in literature and writing. So I just went through the next slide to be able to go through that. We certainly have to think flexibly about not only how we would see the story and describe it, but how would we write it to other people. So social thinking helps to take this really complicated, pretty complicated social landscape and try to figure out how do we take all this implicit social information that babies learn naturally when babies are born to typically developing social brains. They naturally are starting to be able to read other people's plans, watch people's eyes, focus on faces, focus on hands, understand what's happening next. They start to learn all this information we've been talking about in a bundle. We call that synergistically. And now we've got kids whose brains don't make it easy for them. They may be more literal. They may have trouble focusing on reading people. They tend to be more object focused. So how do we take all this implicit information that we're expected to know and understand by the time we get into kindergarten so we can sit in a classroom, 20 kids in a class, one teacher, perhaps in your schools it's less than that, perhaps it's more. But isn't it amazing that five-year-olds can sit in a group in a classroom, look at the teacher, understand what her intentions are because she's not going to tell them everything she expects them to do. She's going to let the environment let them infer what's going on in the environment to figure out where their attention should be focused, what they should be doing. And then we get, every year it gets more and more complicated across school. And then how do we teach all this explicitly to kids whose brains don't help them easily make sense of it? We're obviously not going to be able to do this as efficiently as the typically developing brain. In fact, we're going to be really inefficient in teaching this, and it's going to be a really slow process, and it's shooting a bullet at a moving target because every year typical kids just get better and better and better, and their brains can handle more and more complicated stuff. And our kids with social learning challenges, their brains are also learning, but they can't keep up with normal development. So as I talk about treatment, our goal is to not catch kids up. It's to help kids get better compared to where they are so that we're constantly saying that we're helping kids get more information about the social process without thinking we're getting them closer and closer to what typical is, because what typical is just keeps shifting, as all of you have experienced with watching children mature. So one of the first things I realized when I was working with my students in the high school was, you know, obviously the more I thought about this, the more complicated it became, and that I needed to create some language because my students had language. Let's help expedite the social learning by talking really clearly about our social expectations. And this language that I'm now going to introduce, if you're, some of you I imagine are already familiar with social thinking, that this mainstream is now, language is now being adopted in the mainstream as well as many homes are using it. And so we call it social thinking vocabulary, but it's not just vocabulary. It's teaching a concept. It's helping kids understand the thinking mechanism differently because language helps our thinking and our thinking helps our theory of mind, and they are all bundled together. And as we alter our thinking, we are able to more effectively alter our behavior. As we learn the language of social thinking, and some of the language does sound unusual compared to us, you know, we're so used to saying pay attention, use eye contact. You're not going to hear us really say that in social thinking. I'm going to explain a little bit more why, but a lot of this is based on assumptions. Like the term pay attention is incredibly abstract. Like, what do those words mean? Pay attention. Does not sound like you're supposed to have your body in the group, your brain focused, and thinking with your eyes. And so that's exactly what we want to get into is what does it explicitly mean when we direct you? Let's share really clear information with our students. So let's start with the concept, think with our eyes. Those of you who are familiar with working with younger kids are probably very familiar with the research in joint attention. Joint attention is when you look at a person, you follow their eyes to see what they're looking at. We're making guesses about what they're thinking about. Imagine yourself talking to another person. You're standing with them face-to-face talking, and you see their eyes keep wandering over and looking at something. Your eyes then go to follow their eyes. And if the person seems really distracted, you're probably going to comment on what that person is now looking at or thinking about. So that's what we're going to teach is think with your eyes. Long story short, years ago I realized that we kept teaching kids eye contact, and I was working with some very involved kids, and we kept saying, give me eye contact. And one of the kids I was working with, he raised his chin up and his eyes would look down at the floor. And I realized that he understands that his head is supposed to go up, but he has no idea what to do with his eyes because we just told him eye contact, and he doesn't understand what eye contact means. So I shifted it all and started teaching think with your eyes. We use our eyes to look at other people's faces. We don't just stare at people's eyes. We look at how people are feeling. But we also get them to observe the situation, understand where they are, understand, as I'm going to talk about in a little bit, what's expected. So we not only use our eyes to show we're attending to others, but we use our eyes to also start our problem-solving process about where am I, what's going on, what's this person doing or thinking about. So when we're teaching thinking with our eyes, then we really want to connect kids to this whole idea that literally we think with our eyes. We use our eyes to make guesses about what's going on around us. Think about President Obama. When you hear him speak, he often says, as a public speaker, he'll say the word look. And he often just says look right before he makes a major point. And the reason he's saying look is in our language, looking and thinking are synonymous. I don't know in Hebrew if they're synonymous. I should ask that to some Hebrew speaker when I'm not just giving a talk right here. But it is interesting in so many cultures how looking and thinking are used much of the same language. So how do you teach something like this? So if you're working with kids in elementary school, have kids sit in a circle, and then there's the leader, the teacher, and she talks about the power of her eyes and that the powers that her eyes focus on a person, and when she is asking a question of the person, the only person who's supposed to answer is the one the teacher is looking at. So this makes sense. If you think about it, it's just we often haven't stopped to really think about how our eyes help people to listen with their eyes, think with their eyes. So the teacher sits in a circle and she looks at a student and the person she's looking at is the person who's supposed to answer her questions. So she might say, did you turn your homework in? And she looks at one kid and that kid's expected to say yes. And then she, you know, or maybe no. Then she turns to another kid and says, did you bring your lunch today? And then she turns to another kid and says something like, did you have a good weekend? And each time she looks at a kid, obviously only that one kid she's looking at is supposed to answer, but that's also a place where you ask the other kids, how come you didn't answer? How come only how come only the kid answered who I was looking at? And then you get the kids to go, because you were looking at them, and you go, oh, you know that if I'm looking at that person, I'm thinking about the person, and you're not supposed to answer. Very clever. Good for you. And then you can let the kids take over. Then you let a kid be in charge of asking some questions. And if kids have trouble generating questions, you give a list of questions written out. But the important part is that whoever the kid is looking at is the person who's supposed to respond to that. Another adaptation to this, which you can do even with upper elementary school kids, is you bring a ball. I like to use larger size balls, you know, the thin balls you can buy at Target. But kids like this activity where the teacher is speaking and they say, okay, I'm going to bounce this ball to who's ever thinking about me. So you have to think with your eyes and show me you're interested in me. And then we explain to the kids, if you're looking at the ball, you're thinking about the ball. But if you're looking at me, I know you're thinking about me. And then I'll decide who I'm going to throw the ball to. And then you go, oh, I see, you know, and you name the names of different kids who are looking at you. You go, oh, they're thinking about me. And then you bounce the ball to one kid. You don't name his name. You just bounce it to the kid who's thinking with his eyes. And that kid now has the ball. You go, stop. Great. Now Ami has the ball. Now Ami's going to, he's going to look around and he's going to look who's thinking about him. Ami's only going to bounce the ball to someone who's thinking about him. And now each kid has turn controlling what's going on with the ball based on them being able to be in charge of the ball, as well as the other kids become responsible. If they want the ball, they need to use their eyes to look towards Ami. This may sound really basic, but some of your kids you're working with who may have solid to gifted IQ will struggle with this task because they haven't integrated how active the eyes are in the social learning process. Yet the research is super strong that our eyes are the doorway to social information. So if you are thinking that your kid is too high and you don't need to do this task, do it anyway. I do it with my high school students. I do this with my university students. I don't do the ball, but I will do with questions, and I teach the power of the eyes, because many of our kids will say, I have a sensory response. I'm overwhelmed using my eyes. I prefer to just look down. And when you're talking to me, I hear everything you say. The important thing is that our eyes are not, it's not all about just hearing, that we have to be reading situational cues, emotional cues. We have to be reading where people's gestures, what are they referring to, that communication is all of that. And, you know, think about kids when they graduate, they have to go to job interviews. They can't really walk into the job interview and say, I'm not comfortable looking at you, so just talk to me while I stare at the floor. I also am running a high school group right now and working with them on your brain follows your eyes. If your eyes are looking at the ground, you're probably thinking about something on the ground that you see of interest, and really getting them to see the power of their eyes in the major social thinking mechanism. So I mentioned earlier about expected behaviors. As you use your eyes to think with your eyes, you start noticing what's going on around you. And one of the things we do, as I mentioned, is we don't just look at people, but our brain first actually focuses on the situation, at least it's supposed to. Where am I and what is expected? And so in social thinking, we not only talk about think with your eyes, but we talk about what's expected and unexpected in the situation. When people mess up social thinking, one of the first ways they mess up is they take the term expected and unexpected behavior and they turn it into a behavior plan. You do what's expected, I give you a point. You do what's unexpected, we're going to take away a point. And that is not how this was intended to use. That's when people are messing up using social thinking. Because what we're doing here by talking about expected and unexpected behavior is we're trying to get our students to become social observers or social detectives. We want them to be able to use their eyes and be able to see the situation and understand what we call the hidden rules. So in each situation, there's a number of expected behaviors. So think about, as I mentioned earlier, just in the school environment, kids coming into class, getting ready to start the day, there's a series of expected behaviors they're supposed to do as they come into class, put their belongings away, sit down. And then, but when the teacher starts talking, the whole situation changes, and now that's teacher talk time. Now, how do you know if the teacher is supposed to just talk or whether you're supposed to participate? Because there's different hidden rules. When the teacher is talking, what are you supposed to do with your own behavior? Keep your thoughts in your head, keep your eyes focused forward. And we make this very explicit for kids. But what we're, and adults, this is not just for kids. This is for teaching parents, teachers, everyone. How do we pay more attention to this? What is the situation and what are the hidden rules? The hidden rules leave us to the expected behaviors. So this is part of that whole problem-solving mechanism. And as I've been mentioning, I've written out on the slides a lot of language because this is all going pretty fast and I didn't want you to have to take copious notes. So you have more on the slides or a different way in which I'm saying them here. But as we do, our expected behaviors in one situation are not the other. So I find that it's difficult, like in a classroom, if we just hang up one set of rules and say it, and we say, this is how you're supposed to behave in the classroom. Because it's actually highly imprecise. How you're supposed to behave in a classroom actually depends on how you're adapting your behavior in each situation. Same at home, if we have parents listening in, we don't just say, here's the rules for the house, because there's different rules for when we're getting ready for dinner versus when we're eating dinner versus after dinner. Are you supposed to help? What is your role? What are you supposed to do when you come home from school? What are the hidden rules in that situation? If it's snack time, what are the hidden rules? What are you supposed to do as you're getting ready to do homework is different from doing homework. How about getting ready for bed is different from actually going to sleep? And so if we can all learn to be better observers of the situation and what are the hidden rules, and we call them hidden rules because we just really don't tell people about all the, you know, usually we just expect kids to figure this stuff out. And if they don't figure it out, then we think they're misbehaving. But what we found with our students is that they really don't know the hidden rules. I have this high school group, and I have a very high-level boy who's 14 years old, just diagnosed with ASD, goes to the elite private school in town. And we were talking about what's your favorite something in a conversation. And he was taking so long. And one of the complaints about him is that he's so hard to talk to because he's so precise in his answers, but it takes him forever to kind of come up with a response. And in reality, the research shows we have a quarter of a second that we're supposed to process and respond to people. So we had someone who said, what's your favorite food or something? And the guy just stopped and he thought, and I go, you know, when people say what's your favorite, they don't mean what's your favorite. They mean, what's the quickest thing you can think of to tell us so we can keep the conversation going? That actually, we don't really care what your favorite is. What we care about is that you throw something out that you like more than you dislike when someone says your favorite. And this 14-year-old, this was like 2 weeks ago, he looked at me and he goes, I had no idea. All these years, I was literally thinking that they really wanted me to tell them their favorite. Same thing with like when kids come into class. They sit down, and in most schools, kids are allowed to talk to each other before the teacher starts talking. But I had this group of kids, and the kids were saying, no, the teacher does not want you to talk. She wants you to stay completely silent until the teacher starts talking. And I said, so, like, you're in high school. Have you noticed that every class you go to, the kids are not silent? And they go, yeah, we just thought all these kids were breaking the rules. And it's like, no, the hidden rule is you're allowed to talk before the teacher starts talking. So all of us becoming more sensitive to the situation and the hidden rules and then explaining them as these are the behaviors that are expected is another important key element of social thinking. So that obviously leads us to the unexpected behavior, which are the behaviors that make people feel uncomfortable in a situation. Expected behaviors tend to make people feel comfortable. Unexpected behaviors are ones that are obviously unexpected in the situation. The reason I don't use the words appropriate and inappropriate is that when we tell somebody that their behavior was inappropriate, we're not only letting them know they did it wrong, but we're letting them know that we're upset with them for doing it that way. And I found that when we combined our emotional reaction with the behavior itself, it turned a lot of kids off because they felt like they were being penalized. And when we could just talk about what's expected, what's unexpected, and we just focus on the situation and the hidden rules, it brought kids into the discussion and it made them better spies or social detectives who are trying to figure out the behaviors. It also allowed parents to talk to kids in the community and like going into a restaurant or where, you know, temple, wherever they are, that this is what's expected in the situation, here's what's unexpected, and then we're going to tie that to how it makes people feel. When you do what's expected, it makes people feel comfortable, they tend to treat you well. When they do what's unexpected, it makes people feel uncomfortable, they often will not react to you in a very positive way, they won't treat you so well. One of the things I'm not going over tonight is something called social behavior mapping that lays this all out in a template version. You can find a free article on it on our website. If you have the book Thinking About You, Thinking About Me, this is my core book that introduces a lot of these concepts. So if you have that kicking around there, you can look at social behavior mapping through that book as well. So if you do what's expected and people treat you well, they tend to have good thoughts about you. And if you do what's unexpected, and people tend to have uncomfortable, but what we talk to kids about is people tend to have weird thoughts about you. And kids really like this language of good thought and weird thought. Kids don't really like to talk, that makes me feel comfortable or uncomfortable, but adults are more comfortable with that language. So what that looks like at my clinic is I'm walking down the hall, this happened, I tripped, and a kid popped his head thought and said his head out into the hallway and from a doorway, and he said, "Michelle, weird thought." And you know, we just laughed about it. because what we're trying to do is really work with our students to realize they have expectations for others. They have good thoughts. They have weird thoughts about others. They think with their eyes. And as we teach this, we really want our students to understand this is not us just judging you, that you actually have expectations for us. You have good thoughts. You have weird thoughts. How teachers or parents play this out at times is they do the unexpected behaviors intentionally. In fact, they'll dramatize them for fun and wait for the kid to react. And the kid will go, "What are you doing?" And you'll say, "Oh, is this unexpected? Yeah, I'm having a really weird thought about you." And you're like, "Cool. That's really cool. Look at what a great job you're doing with your own social thinking. Like, this isn't just us wanting you to behave. You actually expect us to actually do this for you as well." This information, in fact, everything I've been sharing with you to this point is not cultural. This is part of our humanity. I give workshops in Argentina and Asia, certainly been to Israel a couple of times, all over the world, explaining social thinking. Now, when we get into the subtleties within each of our cultures, that's where we get into more nuance, and then that becomes cultural. But this whole idea that we have thoughts about each other, we think with our eyes, we have expectations, we have good thoughts, we have weird thoughts, how we feel about you or your behavior affects how we treat you, is something that we can teach everywhere we go. So what's really important here is that people don't hear this and then think, "Oh, you tell a kid that they're weird," and that's part of social thinking, because we never tell anybody that they're weird. We talk about our thoughts as having good thoughts, weird thoughts, or comfortable thoughts, uncomfortable thoughts. These are all about our thoughts. When we're working with little kids, we will put little red thought bubbles and green thought bubbles, and we'll hold them above our heads and talk about the good thoughts we're having and the uncomfortable or weird thoughts. And we really make a big deal about everybody has these kind of thoughts as they're aware, if they're aware of what's going on around them. So the general social rule is the one that I've been explaining to you, that we read the hidden rules, we use expected behavior, people have good thoughts about us and they tend to treat us better. When people ignore, or many of our kids with social learning challenges just are unaware of how to read the social rules, they do unexpected behaviors, we have weird thoughts or uncomfortable thoughts, and then we don't treat people as well, or people don't respond as positively. Another lesson that I've done, this is just some of the core lessons. I think I've come up with 50 concepts over the years, is where is your body in all of this? Because a big part of communication is not only what you say, but it's also what you do with your gestures and your face and your physical presence in a room. So I started teaching this next lesson, which is your body in the group? Is your body out of the group? Is your brain in the group? Is your brain out of the group? Based on what happened years ago when I was working with a group of third graders, and we had had a break, and a number of the kids had walked away to do other things during the break, and then I was calling people back to get going in the group again, and three of the four of the kids came back, and one kid's off in a corner reading a book. And I said, "Okay, guys, time to be part of the group," trying to cue this kid to come back to the group, and he just kind of hollers in from the corner, "I hear everything you say, just keep teaching." And so I thought, oh, how do I teach him that actually I don't think he's part of the group? So I took some Play-Doh, because we had been using Play-Doh, but you can do the same thing with Lego blocks, with wooden blocks. I keep a lot of Legos and blocks around to show where people are in space, and I just put them on the center of the table. And so here you can see four kids, myself. I'm a little bit different shape because I'm the teacher, but I'm still a member of the group. And I said, "Look, guys, this is what our group looks like." And I put in the center of the table because I don't think our kids have great group awareness. I think they tend to be bigger me thinkers. They think about themselves, and they don't really necessarily see them as themselves as a member of the group, even when they're sitting around in a group, was one of the things I learned years ago. So I said, if someone came to the door right now and looked in, they would see us all sitting around the table. They think we're a group. But I was like, "Oh, but wait a minute. That's actually not what they'd see." And then I took Tim's Play-Doh and I just rolled it right off the table. And I go, Tim's body is not in the group. Tim is not in the group right now. His body is not in the group. Tim's in the corner. So Tim shot up from the corner and ran over the table. He goes, "I want my body in the group. Put my Play-Doh back in the group." And I'm like, Okay, I can only do that if your body's actually in the group. Then we think you're in the group. So Tim came back and he sat at the table, and we're now talking about thinking with our eyes, our body in the group. And then the kid next to Tim was still sitting in the group, but his mind kind of rolled up to the ceiling, and he started talking about dinosaurs. And I thought, okay, what do I do with this kid because his body's in the group? So I pulled off a bit of his Play-Doh. I left about a size of a grain of rice in the group, and then I rolled the rest of his Play-Doh off the table, and I go, look, guys, Ryan's body is still in the group, but his brain has rolled away. And then Ryan's like, wait, I want my brain in the group. And I'm like, we can see when your brain's not in the group. And that's what we call paying attention. Is your body in the group? Is your brain in the group? Are you thinking with your eyes? And so you start to get a sense of, if we break the language down and we, rather than talk in summary or abstraction, we're really explicit with kids, that this actually can be helpful for all kids. And if we use this language with all kids in a mainstream setting, then the kids who are the typical kids are also learning the explicit way to talk, so they can give direction in a more explicit way to the other kids in the group who have some more obvious social learning challenges. So one of the things that the public was asking is that we put this into materials that can be used directly with kids, because up until that point, I was only writing books for adults to read. I have a whole book on curriculum, you know, teaching ideas and all. So my colleague and I, Pam Crook, developed You Are Social Detective very intentionally to be able to write out the concepts I've been teaching you in this PowerPoint so far, but teaching it in a way that if you read the book to kids, adults who are reading it are learning the social concepts. So let me just quickly go through kind of, this book is like 52 pages, so you don't usually read it in one setting, but I'll show you some of those pages. So this book has also won a couple of big awards. And here we start with kids have different types of smarts. Some people have computer gaming smarts or music smarts. So we don't want to make this be what we study as adults in school about working memory and all these different ways our brains function. We want to make it real to kids that our brain has many different types of learning abilities. And in school, we use social smarts and school smarts. And then we go on to talk about we're supposed to use school smarts even when we're just sitting next to somebody working in class. And it's really important that we draw these thought bubbles to get kids to realize, even if you're working by yourself, you should still be aware of who's around you, what they're thinking about. Even on the playground, we use our social smarts everywhere we go, not just the classroom, and that kids think about each other's behavior, and we figure out how to behave based on where we are and what we're expected to do at that time. And then we have this little character who pops in and looks at whether people's body are in the group, their eyes are in the group, their brain is in the they're thinking with their eyes, their brain is in the group, and if they look like they're focusing on each other, then he keeps saying, yep, that's expected, yep, that's expected. But then he can also see if somebody's doing a behavior like this boy in the yellow shirt whose body is turned around, the little character says, oh, that's not expected. His body is not in the group, as we kind of build out this language. And then we'll talk about if someone has uncomfortable thoughts about us, we don't feel so good about ourselves and others don't feel great about us either. But prior to getting to there, we've done a whole lot of slides which show that when you do what's expected, we feel good about you, we have good thoughts, we treat you well, you tend to feel good about yourself, here's what it looks like when you're feeling good, but uh-oh, if you do what's expected, then we tend to have uncomfortable thoughts about you, and we don't treat you so well, and you don't react so well either, you may use an unfriendly voice, you may look angry, and then we don't work so well with you. So in the midst of all of that, we end the story on the fact that everybody's a social thinker, even when they're growing up, even if they're going, your moms and dads or teachers are going off to work, they continue have to be thinking about each other and trying to adapt their behavior to mostly have people have good thoughts or comfortable thoughts about them. So that's the briefest summary I could kind of do on the social learning process. There's so many more things, conversational skills, different ways in which we learn to think about how to interpret information. And so that's a big chunk of social thinking, is teaching how to understand what's going on around you and to become more observant and more aware. But that alone is not going to be the end of our teaching. We also want to teach kids self-regulation. And self-regulation is not just staying calm, doing your homework. Social self-regulation is being able to adapt effectively based on the different situations, as we were talking about earlier. So one of the tools that you may have heard of is Superflex. And I mentioned also social behavior mapping, which is one of the tools we use to really teach it very clearly. What you do affects how people feel, how they feel affects how they treat you, how they treat you affects how you feel about yourself. The Social Detective book actually walks teachers and students through all of those steps that lead right up to social behavior mapping. And then I was working with my colleague Stephanie Madrigal, and she was working with a really difficult kid who really needed to work on better self-regulation in addition to the social thinking. Virtually all of our kids need to work on the social skills part as well as the social thinking part. And so she came up with this clever idea of Superflex. And Superflex is a superhero that lives inside each of our brains and helps us use super flexible thinking. And Superflex is not just a comic book, but it's also a curriculum. So there's two books. There's the comic book and the curriculum. And what we looked at as Stephanie and I then began to develop these lessons together is that Superflex is a super flexible superhero in your brain, but he's got a lot of challenges. And one of the challenges in your brain we started with is rock brain. And rock brain makes kids get really stuck on their own rock brain thinking. They think all problems come in one size. There are no choices. So we started with, how do you defeat rock brain from taking over your brain and getting you so upset because you don't use flexible thinking? And so Stephanie started using this with her really grumpy kid and who she'd been highly unsuccessful with. And he came into the sessions really wanting to talk about rock brain in his brain and Superflex and the power Superflex was giving him through strategies we were teaching this boy to be able to defeat the power of Superflex living in his brain. And then I started, because it was so successful with this grumpy 10-year-old, we started using this widely in our clinic with kids, and kids started talking to us about how there's more than just rock brain stuck in their brain. And so we started elaborating on Superflex. I'm going to get there in a minute. If you've heard anything about social thinking, there's a very good chance that what you've heard about is Superflex. And Superflex is not the starting place in teaching. Superflex comes as self-regulation, but you obviously can't really self-regulate or figure out how to adapt your behavior effectively if you're not aware of the situation, being a social detective, being aware of what's going on around you, all that stuff I was talking about earlier. So if you've heard about Superflex, don't just pull this out and start here. You want to go back and do Prime Kids with a lot of other learning, more learning than I've gone over here today. Just as I keep mentioning, we're giving you kind of a scaffold of some main ideas. But as you get into Superflex, it's important that the kids have already learned the basic social thinking vocabulary. It's also really important that we only use this with kids who can distinguish between real and imaginary worlds. If you use Superflex with a kid who may have a normal IQ, but he cannot imagine that every time he watches our cartoon, he thinks he's part of that cartoon. And he just talks, he echoes and constantly talks about cartoons as if they were real. Don't use it with him, because that kind of kid is one that will literally think that these characters are stuck in his brain, and we don't want to use it with that level of a child. But many of our kids, as they're getting up to third to, you know, sixth grade, are really being able to take on this more imaginary world. And then we adults need to make sure that because we've made this cute and friendly and kids really like Superflex, that there's a real journey between recognizing and what about their behavior and understanding how to self-control that same behavior. So one of the mistakes people make with Superflex is once a kid can recognize what we're going to talk about as his unthinkable, what's the power in his brain that's leading him away from superflexible behavior, once a child can talk about it, adults are too quick to say, well, if he can tell me what he needs to do, he should just go do it. None of us are very good at that. Think about your own life, whether it's eating healthier, exercising more, slowing down your driving, that most of us know what we need to do, but we're not great at doing it, especially if we're learning a new behavior. But for some reason with kids, we expect if they can tell us what they should do, that they should just do it. And then we get annoyed that they're not just doing it, especially when it comes to their social behavior. So appreciate that these are very slow lessons and that we take kids on a journey of self-awareness, self-monitoring, self-control, and that adults have to really kind of go on this journey too and really take on what is my unthinkable in my brain, how hard is it for me to change this behavior so that we can be, really honest with kids about this behavior change or evolving into behavior change process. When we look at Superflex, the journey starts in what we call social town, and we talk to kids about social towns become a dark place since the disappearance of Superflex, and kids are not behaving well towards each other. They're being quite mean to each other because Superflex is not being able to be found in this town. And then the story goes on to talk about this kid, Aiden, and how Aiden was being one of these really rude kids, and then he ended up with his dog while he was throwing a toy to his dog. His dog came back with this little blue brain in his mouth, and the blue brain is the missing Superflex in town. And when Aiden got hold of the little blue brain and goes, what's this? But all of a sudden he was kind of bestowed with superflexible thinking because he found the missing Superflex brain in town. It's a stretch, but kids love it. And then we start working with kids now that Superflex has become kind of the superhero that helps to teach other kids about social thinking, that that they're going to be learning a lot about their unthinkables and understanding what's going on in social town so that they can do more expected behaviors. So now I'm showing the top and bottom of some different posters. This all is written up in this little storybook, but in the interest of time, here are some of our unthinkables. We have up in the left, upper left corner, rock brain. Each of the unthinkables has power. So all of these characters around Superflex are called the team of unthinkables. Each unthinkable has power to make your brain get stuck. And so rock brain makes people get stuck on their ideas. Glass man makes people have huge upset reactions. I developed glass man because I had these kids who were not working themselves up to really getting upset. If you didn't call on them in class, they like hit the floor and broke like a pane of glass. They just started crying and sometimes screaming because they didn't get their way. So we were talking about, you know, that glass man's living in their brain and making them get really upset really quickly. Doth, the destroyer of fun, makes people overly competitive. Mean Gene makes people act mean and bossy. One-sided Sid gives people to talk only about themselves. On the left side, Space Invader, he gets people to just invade people's personal space. Following on the upper left, we have Was Funny Once. He's very popular. He gets people to use humor at the wrong time, person, or place. We have Topic Twistermeister. I make people jump off topic. Brain Eater gets people distracted, so they're not paying attention to what's going on around them. Worry Wall makes people worry too much. Body Snatcher moves people's body out of the group. Unwonderer makes people lack social wonder or curiosity, so they don't show interest in others. Energy Harry, I give people too much energy. And Grump Grumpinini, I put people in grumpy moods. So that was our original team of 14. But what happened from there was as soon as we released this curriculum, people started sending us, teachers, parents, kids, emails about all these unthinkables that they were creating. And so we have a whole lot of energy and a whole lot of interest in Superflex. People are using Superflex and Social Detectives school-wide across elementary schools to teach kids the power of social thought and then social regulation. So that's kind of the main idea of what social thinking introduction could look like in the elementary school. We have different strategies for middle school and high school as the social world becomes more sophisticated, and certainly for adults. We also have curriculum for 4 to 7-year-olds where we break this down into storybooks and music. You can see a lot of our free articles on our website. We really are devoted to putting free information out there so that you don't have to buy a book in order to get started understanding what we're all about.
Well, thank you, Michelle, for that fabulous presentation. I think my brain is stuck on those unthinkable characters.
Yeah, don't we all, huh?
I love that. I need them like in little puppets. So I know we'll be all be browsing your website for additional ideas and materials, and I've been on it actually already a number of times, and it is such a rich resource, I think both for educators and for parents. So I do recommend that everybody go check out socialthinking.com. In just a minute, we're going to be addressing some audience questions. If you have a question, please feel free to type it in the chat box. Before we do, I just want to alert you all to the next two scheduled Hidden Sparks Without Walls webinars. We have one on the 24th, and that's really for Judaic Studies teachers, The Art of Teaching Rashi to the Struggling Student. It should be a very, very strong webinar. And then we have in March, Sensory Processing Strategies for the Home. And that's primarily targeting parents, but obviously some teachers will learn quite a bit from that as well. I also want to let everybody know that we are going to be offering a Learning Lenses blended course this summer. And those of you who are on our mailing list will be getting emails. Applications should be available in early March. One question, Michelle, that came up. I know you mentioned that a lot of the kind of social thinking skills are gender neutral. I think you mentioned that. But I think when the superflex came up, it prompted a question in terms of if you see differentiation between boys and girls in how issues manifest, and if you think materials need to be different if you're working for a group of if you're working with a group of boys or a group of girls.
Yeah, it's a really interesting question because there's a lot of discussion out there about the difference with girls and boys. And I think at the elementary school level, I think a lot of the stuff that I've, everything I've talked about today is core information that's relevant to all in very similar ways. Now, one of the things we're very aware of is when we came out with Superflex, a lot of our characters were male when, and most of our clients are male, but not all, and that we're being more sensitive now. We're making more gender-neutral characters or bring in more female characters. But in general, the social thinking strategies, we teach them very similarly. Where you start to get into differences in gender, I think, come in, and you know, we can break this down and certainly argue it's case by case, but I'm going to speak in generalities here, that when you're getting up into the teaching the nuance, teaching more subtleties, girls relate differently than boys, and so we're going to talk about in with girls about the girl world of hanging out in groups and having conversations and all. But that's going to get to a level of lessons that I haven't even begun to touch on here in terms of that culture around them. I saw a question come through that I wanted to address that I can see written there, and one of the questions it was, let me see if I can scroll back up on it, had to do with the language like I make people feel. When we're teaching social behavior mapping, well, let me back up and say no social teaching is going to be perfect teaching because we've got to take this really complex engine and break it down into some really concrete parts. And so in the field of special ed, everything we teach is imperfect in terms of social learning because we could get really stalled out on the exceptions. And in general, what we're doing with social behavior mapping is working on these predictable elements that if you do this, it tends to affect people in a very social, emotional cause and effect. And a lot of my clients weren't getting, in fact, I have adult clients, college-age clients, I have kids with really high IQ who did understand their behavior affects how people feel affects how they treat them. Now, there are always going to be exceptions, but when we're coming up with major ideas, what we're trying to do is teach that what you do affects how people feel. We're not saying that I make people feel this way, that this will definitely, but you get to decide what goes on the map in terms of language you're comfortable with. When it comes to the unthinkables and superflex, we're talking about the characters inside a person's head. So if they have grump crumpanini in their head, grump crumpanini tends to make people feel really grumpy, but we're not saying somebody else is making you feel that. We're saying inside of your head, how can you control how you're interpreting or how you're reacting to information? So I agree that we don't want to say this is definitely, when this happens, you're definitely making people feel this way. But I also wanted to address one more thing in that person's question, and that is they said some kids laugh, like when something unexpected happens, somebody laughs. But I've studied this, and when people are laughing, it doesn't mean they think it's funny, and it doesn't mean they think it's okay. That a lot of us laugh out of discomfort, and this is something I work with my adults on. I work with my teens, my young kids. We're actually writing the Was Funny Once book right now, and really teaching that often people laugh out of nervousness and discomfort because we don't tell you when we're uncomfortable with your behavior, and we often want to make it seem like it's okay because in our social code around the world, we are not likely to say what you just did was really rude, it's unacceptable. We most likely won't tell the person that we had a weird thought about them, but we have no problem telling five of our friends. And that's just kind of humanity social code across different cultures, even more direct cultures. And I know Israelis tend to be more direct, but that doesn't mean we're telling everybody that we're uncomfortable with their behavior. We just may do it. We may be a little bit more direct than other cultures, but it doesn't mean we're always direct around this stuff.